The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. My name is Andy Cahan, and I'm the Director of Author Events here, and I'm very pleased and honored to welcome one of the best sports writers in the business. Since 1968, columnist George Vesey has covered the Olympics, tennis, football, hockey, boxing, baseball, and a variety of other sports for the New York Times. The author of more than a dozen books, including the bestseller Stan Musial, An American Life, he has co-written several celebrity autobiographies, Loretta Lynn, Coal Miner's Daughter, most notable among them. In his new book, 8 World Cups, My Journey Through the Beauty and Dark Side of Soccer, Vesey writes about the enduring phenomenon of worldwide soccer and sheds light on the game's superstar personalities, backroom dealings, rabid fans, and the on-the-field heroics of the last 8 World Cups. The Christian Science Monitor instructs, a few days reading Vesey and life on the pitch becomes beautiful and the game understandable. Please welcome George Vesey.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks for being here on such a beautiful evening. Coming indoors, not easy in this time of the year, but I appreciate you being here. I have to ask a question first. How many of you all watched the match last night, the soccer match? Wow. We're at critical mass. And I'm going to have Q&A at the end of this. After I'm going to talk a little bit about the book, but we'll do Q&A. So the hardcore, for y'all who know more about soccer, football than I do, you can ask the technical questions. Why didn't he keep Donovan on the team? I'll answer all those questions. Well, you're going to ask that. Anyway, glad to have it. But first, I just want to chat a little bit about the book and my involvement in soccer, how I came to this point, and watching it go from a curiosity in 1982 to what it is right now, which is like a national phenomenon. I guess I'm not surprised that soccer is at its peak right now. People are excited about it because I've watched it develop over the last 32 years. I went to Spain in 1982 and covered that first World Cup, the first of 8. And people didn't know where I was. They didn't know what I was covering. Why is a New York Times sports columnist over there when, you know, the Yankees are trying to win another pennant, or, you know, this and that? And it was a curiosity, but it was fun for me as a journalist. And I was so glad to do it. And I've watched it grow every 4 years. But at the moment, it's just crazy. I mean, the front page articles about on the main paper, not the sports section, about how the game was played, why they lost, or why they gave up the goal at the end of the match. And it's an entirely different feel of it. The television ratings came out this afternoon. My friend Kurt just sent me, there's an old TV guy, sent me the ratings for the U.S.-Portugal match, and they are, both in ESPN and in Univision, they were just the highest ratings, for soccer that they've had for the World Cup for a U.S. team, and leaping way ahead, you know, geometrically ahead of what they've had before. So it says something about the sport. It says something about the electronic age. And for me, I've been interested in watching it come along. Don't take any credit for it, but to the details, what people can deal with, and I can tell from the show of hands, the details that people can talk about now of the way the match is played, the way the sport is. Why was nobody marking that man? Why was nobody near the man who scored the goal on the header last night? What should have been done? People have their theories about it. I knew in 2006 that something was really happening with soccer when I was over in Germany and the U.S. was playing what turned out to be a terrific match, epic, against Italy. Do you remember that? The 1-1 draw that they played where they were down a player. They had 9, Italy had 10, and the U.S. gutted it out and held on for against a very good team that would win the championship. And I remember getting an email while I was down in Kaiserslautern before this match. I was getting emails from Americans saying, Bruce Arena's got to go. We don't like his lineup. We don't like the way he's playing DeMarcus Beasley on the right side. Doesn't he know that Beasley prefers the left side? This is when DeMarcus was still a winger. And people were second-guessing him. They wanted him fired right now, you know, like it was the Yankees, like they were George Steinbrenner clones out there in the middle of America. You know, and while I've never asked Bruce this question, I can only assume that if he heard that, he would smirk in his classic Long Island smirk and say, well, that's nice, that meaning that it was good for soccer, that if people wanted his head, of course, eventually his head was gotten at the end of that tournament for not winning, which is normal anyway. But the critical mass was of people coming after the coach, and it was the electronic age. It was being done through the media, through the electronic, the social media, even as limited as I am in it. I was getting emails from all over the place. Of course, my favorite email, just to tell you how the world has shortened, in 2002, we were in Seoul, South Korea, just having a great time. My wife and I were staying in this lovely hotel, and I was having a great time going all around this wonderful country on trains and covering matches. And I covered a match, and I can't even remember where, because it all kind of blurs when you just get on trains and go to stadiums, but I covered a match between South Korea and Italy. If anybody knows where I was, you know, tell me, but it could have been Busan and it could have been Suwon, who knows. But anyway, I get back to my hotel that night or on the train or whatever it was, and I download my emails, and I'd written about the Italy match that the player, Francesco Totti, had taken a dive. And I said he deserved the yellow card that got him thrown out of the match, that it was his dive that earned him that. It wasn't the referee's problem. It was his problem for faking it and going down, getting him thrown out of the game. So I get back to my hotel room, and I open up my emails. And there's a email, and the first words are, anybody speak Italian? Okay, the first words are, devi morire.
You must die.
Exactly, you must die. And I just laugh because, and by the way, if you speak Italian, I've actually got the word spelled wrong in the book. I have it in what I think is like the, I think an extra letter in an extra vowel. You know, always extra vowels in Italian, but this one, I think I have it slightly off. But anyway, that was it, you must die. And it just told me that somebody, whether the person was in Italy or not, I don't know. Of course, I answered him in my wretched Italian. But that's how much the world has shrunk a little bit. But now, in homeland United States, you know, non-ethnic, whatever that means, homeland United States, people are into it. And I knew that again just the other day. I've been doing this radio tour of America. No longer, this is my book tour, by the way. This is as far as I'm straying from New York City, because it's fun to do, because I have family here and it's great to be here. But nowadays you can do a lot of it even on Skype, that you don't have to necessarily be in a place to be there. And I got the 10 radio interviews in one day all lined up for me. And one was for Boise, Idaho. And they're interested in talking about the World Cup. And they put you on hold. The producer gets you on. They put you on this kind of limbo area. You be on hold. But you can hear what's happening on the radio station. So what was on was a commercial. And the commercial was for Big Al's Sports Pub in downtown Boise, Idaho. And Big Al's was featuring the World Cup special. $10 for a burger and all the beer you can drink for every match during the World Cup. Now, I listened to this, and they put me on. I go live on the radio in Boise, and I just laughed, and I said, you guys are telling me everything I need to know about soccer in America, that if in Boise, Idaho, Big Al's figures that it's good business to keep it open for the, you know, the Greece-Nigeria match or the this or the that, you know, matches that people don't necessarily care about in Boise. You know, where they're not playing Montana State in American football. They're playing, you know, they're playing soccer. But this was a big deal. And I've been reinforced even by the questions that people have been asking me. I go on the radio and somebody said, why isn't Donovan on the team? Or, you know, what's it about? When is Klinsmann going to be more aggressive, put two strikers up front and so on? It's a different world than the world I encountered in 1982. I got a email this morning from a friend of mine who's a folk singer in New York, Christine Lavin. I don't know if any of you know her, but she's just been a joy over the last generation, funny, quirky folk songs. And Christine was talking about people in New York. She's performing this week and all that back in New York. And she was talking about the buzz that she's picking up on. So I think we're all into it, that America has discovered it. I take no credit. I was there. There are so many other factors for it. Obviously, the internet, cable television, and then somebody pointed out to me the electronic games. Somebody recently, I was at my alma mater, Hofstra University, had an academic symposium on soccer. And I was talking about those two factors, and somebody said, don't forget the electronic games, the FIFA game that you play. And I remember my niece, Lulu here, Lulu the midfielder, will remember when George took me to play, we were playing the game in your living room, her older brother, and he's playing me in the FIFA game, and he's saying, Pop, you're not even trying. And I'm saying, I'm trying. I've got old guy syndrome, and I just can't think and react as fast or as motivated or whatever. But my synapses just weren't as good. But from playing these games, you know who Maldini is, and you know who Baresi is, you know who Baggio is, and you know whatever the names are, Suarez and so on. And you play it, and it becomes even the uniforms, what they look like. You let to see the blue Azzurri jerseys of Italy and so on. It's become familiar. So the whole thing has come in like a swarm, like a wave. And for a couple of newspaper people, myself and a few others who were out there in 1982 and were at the sort of forefront of it for American papers, you know, it was nice to do, but for me it was as much a personal journey, which leads me to the book. I use the word journey in the title, and I realized that when I retired from full-time writing a sports column at the New York Times, I retired at the end of 2011, and I had all these stories that I tell people, and you know, old people like to tell stories, old guys tell stories about their business, so you try not to be, but I wanted some place to collect them, to put them in order, and to make sure that I actually had them right. So I asked them, sent around, and they actually came up and said, do this book. And the title is My Journey Through the Beauty and Dark Side of Soccer. And the dark side I'll get to in a bit, but it grew on me. It wasn't going to be in the subtitle, but it sort of grew on me as just about all the top officials, except the top one, got bounced for criminality. And that, so the dark side was in there, and which leads to Qatar. But it was so much fun to be out there and covering the event in 1982. The way I did it, and I tell this in the book, I tell the story about being I was voted, by the way, at my high school has been phased out. It's not going to exist after this year. Classic new education, get rid of the grand old schools. But I played for Jamaica High School in Queens, and it was an ethnic neighborhood, and they had a soccer team. They didn't have an American football team, so I went out for the team because it was a play. They had a position called fullback, and it looked like I could hit somebody. You know, if you hit somebody, an American fullback, you can hit somebody. So I was bigger than I am now and huskier, and it just seemed like the sport to play. So I went out for the sport knowing nothing about it. And I went out, and there were 10 or 12 different ethnic guys on the team. The best player on the team was German-American, and his father had come from Kaiserslautern from Bavaria and had moved to Ridgewood, Queens, and he was Bob was such a good player. We had an Italian guy, we had an Argentine, we had a Puerto Rican, we had a Venezuelan, we had a French guy, we had a Polish guy. And they all played. That's good. It's very American. But on a soccer team, maybe not so good because they played different styles. So you had one winger, he was used to long ball, so he'd pound the ball upfield. And the guy on the right wing, he believed in short passes. And the coach didn't know anything. The one thing he could do was to open the ball bag and turn it upside down and let the balls out and say, okay, you guys go out and practice. When I used to go and watch my grandkids play, my grandkids, they would play in drills. I would see them doing roll out the ball, go around the cones, and do all this stuff. And I say, why didn't Mr. Harrington have these drills? And rudimentary stuff. We did nothing. We'd practice no skills, no nothing. It was just go out and play. So I didn't learn, I knew nothing. I was a terrible player. I was worst defender in the history of Jamaica High School. I was voted that. Well, I voted myself that. That's on my Twitter account or something, you know, voted worst defender in the history of Jamaica High School. But it's terrible to be a bad player at anything. To see, there was a German-American guy, and I found him, and it's in the book. You'll buy it, you'll find the punchline. But I was out there guarding this guy, marking this guy in Ridgewood, Queens, in Massbeth at a high school up on a plateau facing New York City. And at me, with the sun at his back, comes this guy named Booby, Reinhard Booby Herring, a thick-necked guy. And they were all, I don't know what language they were shouting instructions, German, American. They were coming at me and they're moving the ball. Had no idea that anybody could play the game this well and move the ball this well and be so coordinated. And he went around me for, I don't know, 6 or 8 goals in one afternoon. That was normal. And I felt terrible about it until later I learned just how good he was. It's in the book of what I later discovered as part of my research for going after starting this book, which was the fun of it, of going back and discover things that I didn't know until it was time. So with this background of having been vaguely aware that some people played soccer fairly well, I went out to Newsday. I was working on Long Island for the paper, and I heard about a documentary called Goal, made by a couple of British guy had written it, who's still with us in London, named Brian Glanville. And I went and I saw this in 1967, and it was about the 1966 World Cup. And I was just totally captivated by it. It was just watching the English beat the West Germans in the final at Wembley. And the characters, the people in it. I had no idea these people existed. And it's easy to say now, you know, oh, this American, where was he? Why wasn't he paying attention? But in those days, in 66, or even when I started to cover it, 1982, it was like another land. You couldn't read and buy stuff. You couldn't find, there was no internet, by the way, you know, kids, there was no internet in 1982. So you couldn't, really, I mean, you have to stop and think. You couldn't just go in and Google up World Cup, Google up Socrates of Brazil. You couldn't do that. So there we go. But in 1967, I'm seeing this World Cup, and suddenly, out of nowhere, I'd heard the name Pelé. I mean, I was a sports writer. I'd heard the name Pelé, and all of a sudden, they materialized on the screen, and this dignified guy named Eusebio, playing for Portugal. Eusebio passed just in the last year, and I got to write his biography, his obituary in the Times, and just to learn more about him as I was up there, the history of it, and I'm still learning. But in those days, to see these people materialize, didn't know. And then to watch on television, to see how they, in the documentary, to see how they move the ball, how good they were, to watch the Russians and the Hungarians, the Soviet Union players and the Hungarians play in sort of a blood match, just a nasty match. And the Soviet guys are elbowing the Hungarian guys, you know, because that's what Russian guys do with Hungarian guys. They elbow them into the sidelines. And it was just amazing to watch. I didn't know it existed. So I had that as a background. And then in 1982, I had just been appointed a sports columnist at the New York Times. And the question is, for the you who know the work I've done and have seen the place I've been, how did you get to cover the first World Cup? The answer is, I had been working cityside at the Times. I was a news guy for 10 years, and I knew the top editors. And you know, from whatever company you work, wherever you live, if you've got, as we say in New York, and probably in Philadelphia too, if you've got a rabbi in high places, and I had the top rabbis at the paper. They were my, you know, I was their guy. They weren't my guys, but I was their guy. And when I went to them and said, thanks for giving me this job as a sports columnist, I'd like to take a look at the World Cup. It's being held. The United States isn't in it. And they said, yeah, you're our guy. Sure, go ahead. You do it. And they made it possible for me to go and cover it. And I went to Barcelona, showed up in Barcelona, this gorgeous city that my wife and I had been to several times. And I get there, and they're playing the second round. And there are three teams. There are two groups. One group was in Nou Camp, of lesser interest, but you covered it. The second group was Brazil, Argentina, and Italy, the ultimate group of death. Three of the greatest nations, 6 World Cup championships among them. And I was going to watch them in this little funky stadium called Sarriá, a little place where you could actually see, and not only could you see, but I go in there for the first match, and there's Maradona, 21-year-old Diego Armando Maradona, a little stumpy guy, was left off the team in 78. Now they won the championship. Now he's the big hope of Argentina for the future, and he's playing, and he's being marked by a guy named Claudio Gentile for Italy, number 6. And I refer to Gentile as non molto gentile, not very civil at all, because he would just be beating. I could hear, That's how small the stadium was and intimate. I was in about the 10th row, and Gentile was kicking away at the shins of Maradona. And Maradona, after a while, would start to flop and go down and whatever, and they were just hacking away at each other. But it was just amazing stuff to watch how good these players were. And I couldn't follow the ball. Now, this may sound like, you know, old babe in toyland or naive or something like that, but there's nothing worse than being over your head. And anybody, you know, if any of you have ever been over your head in something, believe me, I was, because I couldn't follow the ball. I couldn't tell what these guys were doing. I didn't know who they were, vaguely. You know, I knew who Maradona was. And I see this shaggy guy for Brazil named Socrates, and they all have the one name, which you know, and I assumed that Socrates was because he was wise or smart or something. Well, it turned out he was a graduate of medical school. He was literally a doctor who had done a little bit of work, but now, because he was so good, he was playing in the best professional, and he's playing in the World Cup. And it was his name. It was his given name. His family believed in the classics. Brazil is a very complicated country. So this Socrates, this genius of a player in midfield, making these beautiful passes. The ball would come to him, and he would just, and I don't know how he got the ball 10, 15 yards up the field, sideways to somebody else. He'd give it to Falcao. Falcao with his long hair streaming behind him, and he's running down the field, maybe advancing at 10, 15, 20 yards, and then Falcao would let loose a ball, and he'd put it right up above the bar, right up to the goal, and there would be, from out of nowhere, you know, like a point guard, like a forward in basketball, came leaping, somebody named Junior or Zico or something like that, human projectiles, and they're flying at him, flying Wallendas out of nowhere to head the ball, you know, much like Varela last night. Well, Varela was low, he wasn't up in the air, but out of nowhere would come these guys and they'd strike it. Maybe they'd miss by that much, but this had happened in a few seconds, of Socrates to Falcao to, you know, up there. And I couldn't follow what had happened, what foot, who had done it. I didn't know the players. So it's an education. The education of an American sports columnist taking place in live time in Barcelona, Spain. And I was there. Fortunately, I had a guy sitting next to me who was, I think he was American also, but he was working for Associated Press. He was Italian, Enrico. And he was telling me about the game. He was trying to help me. Very nice fella. And he was pointing out, telling me stuff in between plays or whatever, telling me who Socrates was and who Falcao played in Roma and this and that. So I was getting my education on the fly, not the way you want to do it, not the way. But I was there as sort of a curiosity anyway. I mean, the times I wasn't covering it for people who knew anything about it. The interesting thing was that, and I, you know, don't let this get back to them, but Times editors generally know very little about sports, and particularly very little about soccer. In those days, some of these guys had lived in these countries, but they didn't know. Like on Saturday morning, they'd be going out to do the beautiful, great world foreign correspondent job they did, and they see these crowds going with the scarves and the chants, but they didn't quite know where these people were going unless somebody tore up a tram or did something hooligan-like. But they were fine. Their learning curve was like mine. It was a great combination of let's all get in this together. So it was a great fun to be out there and write about not only what was in the games, but what happened in the streets. Wandered out to the Ramblas in Barcelona, and we'd been there, wandering around and drinking the horchata, the nut drink that they drink, and watching people sell canaries under the trees, and the statue of Columbus down by the harbor. I mean, just a gorgeous place. And there I am in Barcelona, and I hear this noise. I hear this sort of throaty Portuguese chanting, and I hear some horns and some drums and some guitars. And here comes a little makeshift, fun Brazilian band, La Torcida, the twisting thing that goes through the streets of wherever Brazilians go, because they're the nicest people in the world. And I hear this music and I hear the noise and I follow them around, and you know, they were all beautiful, you know, plus the men, and the women were, and it was gorgeous and fun, and you just wanted to be in their midst. They weren't like the soccer crowds that you associate, or our American crowds with the USA, USA. These were musical people and fun, and I realized that on the field and off, whether it was Socrates or the beautiful people wandering around the Ramblas, that Brazil was the heart of football, the heart of soccer. So when I sit here in the States watching these matches from these places, and ESPN does a good job. They've had really good people out to watch, and my sort of heart's been in my mouth watching my friends from ESPN prepare for it, going down there and for years to get to know Jeremy Schapp and Wright Thompson and some of the people out there in the street, as well as the soccer people themselves, getting to learn about the country. And I just feel like it's in the right place, whether the protests will work out and how that doesn't seem to have impeded them. But just to see that, my love for Brazil goes back to that year, to 1982. Followed it up, it's in chronological order, but just to bring it up to the present tense, in writing the book, and this is a writer's series, so this is somebody telling you how he put together a book about soccer. And I knew it had to be chronological. I mean, sports, things happen in chronological order, and then covering 8 World Cups, you might as well tell them in order. But I got down to the 2010 World Cup, and I was putting it together, which would logically be the 8th and last in a series of them. And I interspersed it. I made sure, by the way, that I included the women, the great women's dynasty, the 99ers, because they were as heroic, as great a bunch of American athletes as I have ever covered. And I made sure to get them in there. But while I was working on the 2010 chapter, I started to describe the Donovan goal, the one that he scored, and you all remember that, I'm sure, that the 91st minute of play against Algeria in 2010 in Pretoria. And I said, I really don't know enough about that. I was there. I was on jet lag. I'd been sent over a little bit late, and they asked me to write about it suddenly out of nowhere, and I'm covering this match as a columnist, and they score, and I'm, you know, 7 time zones away and totally zonked, and they scored the goal, and I tried to recreate it as best we could, talking to the athletes. But now, a couple of years later, I want to recreate it, and I went back, and I got YouTube is a wonderful thing. Again, there was no YouTube back in the day. You couldn't go back and find things. Now, it is so amazing for a writer to be able to go back and find a YouTube of the play, the beginning with Tim Howard fielding the ball at chest level, kind of a weak shot. And Howard, I realized I got tears in my eyes as a writer, because you're being handed this material that, and you're seeing things you think you saw, you try and remember. And memory, we all know this, memory is a funny thing. You think you remember something. I did a baseball book a few years ago, baseball history book. This was a Stan Musial book. And 2 famous baseball players from many years ago, who's still alive, and you would remember them, both told me stories that turned out not to be true. They weren't lying. They were in the stadium. It happened. They just weren't on the field. Both of them had themselves on the field. One was in the dugout, one was in the bullpen, separate incidents. So you have to really check your own memory, because if people that I trust who were trying to tell me that they... Anyway, I went back and I looked at the YouTube, and to see what those players accomplished. And I was able to catch Clint Dempsey when he was in New York about a year ago, when he signed with Seattle. He came through New York to be, do a little dog and pony show around. And I asked him about that play. He was in the middle of it, in that he had gone tumbling into the goal mouth, distracting the goalie, probably this close from getting himself a yellow card or a distraction warning or something. But I was so awed by what these did. Now, here's a writer talking in the age of the computer, being able to take what I've written, and it was going to be chapter 14 or 15 or 16 or wherever it fit. And I said, this has to go as the first chapter in the book. It has to be the way to present soccer to readers, whether they know the sport or not, whether they care about it or not. I want to be able to write about it in a way that makes it readable and makes it real, and it's out of chronology, and it doesn't have to be an artistic... I always like to have a nice foreword or prologue to a book that's a little bit different, a little bit weird, a little bit personal or psychological for me or the person I'm writing the book for, confessional in some cases. But this was just so pure football of what they did. And I really got emotional, got tears in my eyes just figuring out how this goal came to be. From the time that Tim Howard handled the ball, I went back to seeing him in Connecticut where they had done some training on the way in. And Bill Russell, the great old basketball player, the U.S. had brought him in. The guy had won more championships than anybody in history, college Olympics and with the Celtics. And he brought in Bill Russell. What could Bill Russell teach about soccer? He could teach winning. He could teach, a little bit stooped over now, and he was once described as an eagle with a beard, but now the beard is white and he's a little stooped and he came in, but he was there. And coming off the practice field, and this is digressing backwards to Hartford, Connecticut, off the practice field, he's walking in. Tim Howard, the goalkeeper, whom I knew to be a great high school basketball player, was walking behind Russell. And Russell goes by, and what a presence. You know, you're just like, wow, there's Bill Russell. And then comes Howard. So Howard knows me. He knows the American reporters. And we're standing there. And I said, did you tell Russell you could dunk on him? Now, Howard's got a great expressive face. You probably saw him after the game last night. He's just the smartest, nicest guy you can imagine. And Howard looked at me like, are you crazy? No, you don't tell Bill Russell I could dunk on you now. And I could, you know, you don't do that. And of course, I guess he knew that I was goofing on him with him. But anyway, he had been around Russell. They had seen him. And that was the start to me, somehow or other, mystically, to see Howard and Russell kind of walking up into the locker room together. So here's Howard starting the play, and like a basketball player, like a 6'1" leaper from South Jersey, from wherever he was, South Brunswick, New Jersey, and he catches the ball and he throws one of these great passes out to Donovan, and Donovan, the beach boy, picks it up, runs up the field, dishes it off to Josie Altidore, a Haitian-American guy on the right side. Josie, not the most finesse player in the world, dribbles, goes in a direct line, and then swerves in toward the goal, exactly what he should, doing it right. And then he realizes he's not going to be able to carry it in by himself. He blasts the ball in, puts it on the frame toward the goal. Clint Dempsey, tough kid from East Texas, grew up playing against Mexican kids out in the field, as hard knocks a guy as you can imagine on a national team. Anybody who says that soccer is for suburban kids in the United States, not totally, because there's Clint Dempsey. And he went sliding through, almost whacking the goalkeeper, I'm sure distracting him to some degree. And then 100 yards up the field from where he started comes Landon Donovan to finish the play, knock the ball into the net. It was the perfect play. And tears came to my eyes watching this thing, realizing how if any of them had made one wrong move, you know, lost the ball the way Michael Bradley did last night, or Claudio Reyna did in 2006, just the ball, you know, got away from him for a goal. And if any of it had gone wrong, if any of them had gotten too giddy on the field, none of this would have happened. The U.S. wouldn't have gone. The difference between it, but it was 110 yards of excellence down the field, getting everything right. So I reconstructed that for the first chapter. That's the way it begins. It's out there. And I was able to tell, finally, after 32 years, I was able to tell the story of what soccer looks like and what it feels like to be out there on the field and to cover it with maybe a little bit more expertise than I had when I started. It's a different game now, and in some ways, you know, we're expected to know more about it and we're expected to have a little bit of expertise. So I think I have over the years. I'm not in Brazil, as you can tell. I'm here. Somebody said, would you have liked to have been in Brazil? Well, I retired a couple of years ago. My heart tells me I'd love to be in Brazil, but I guess maybe I'd like to, you know, to go there sometime, visit friends and get around and see the Brazilian people. The work is hard. The reporters, the stuff you read today, the New York Times had a couple of our reporters there. Sam Borden was there, and Juliet McCord did a column after the match. I'm sure she did it exactly right on deadline, having to reconstruct the last minute, a 95th minute goal. She had to reconstruct the way I had to reconstruct a Landon Donovan goal 4 years ago. The difference was that I had seven hours on my side, and Juliet was had maybe one. So time was not favorable to her. But Times has good people there, and I'm glad to write about it. I'm glad to read about it from a distance. But it's compelling watching. I'll be doing it next Thursday again. Couple of things. That's about my book. Couple of things. I would love to hear from you all and answer your questions about soccer, about working for the New Yorker. I don't know what happened about the editor of the Times. I'll tell you that in advance. You know, it's corporate secrets. I can't tell. I'd just like, for the record, to say to introduce a few people before I, as an old guy, got my chronology mixed up. Of course, Lulu Wilson is my granddaughter. She plays for a very fast team out of the Philadelphia area to be a very good player. My daughter, Corinna V. Wilson, works out of Harrisburg. Maybe you've seen her on PCN working around. She's now a big macha, as we say in Harrisburg. And my wife, Marianne, who's in the book all over the place, and she's got a life of her own. She's an artist, painter, and she's also been to India 12 or 13 times, brought back about 30 children for adoption. And in the book, she sometimes is telling me all about, and that's another part of the book. She's telling me all about the cities we're in. We rented a flat in Rome, hard duty, flat in the Piazza Sforza Cesarini, opposite the Piazza Navona, hard duty. I would go to the matches. She would come back and tell me what was happening in the town. She'd say, you know, Rome is deserted. There's nobody here. She said, I was in a shop on the Via Giulia today, and the woman said, Signora, you tell your husband nobody comes to the World Cup. Soccer fans don't spend money. The Germans, they drive down the Autobahn. They go to the match. They drive home for work. The Irish, they have no money. They don't even have long pants. And they were gone. And they were telling all the people. And so I was learning about the World Cup through my wife, and the economics. Now, when people tell you that the World Cup is a boon to any host city, I say, well, I know different, because every place I go, you know, somebody's saying, Signora, soccer fans don't spend money. They don't buy art objects. They don't necessarily have good meals. Anyway, I learned from my wife. She's all through the book. In Seoul, South Korea, she would grab me and say, you have an afternoon off. We are going to the arts center. And she'd take me across to this beautiful arts center in the hill, and we watch a form of Korean rap called pansori. Now, how many sports writers get led by the arm to watch Korean rap, folk rap, in an arts center? I've been blessed, not only in with my wife, but in having her there to enlarge the way I see the world and the way this book came out. And finally, I'd love to take your question. I just want to introduce one friend of mine, longtime friend, Kurt Block, who lives in your city now. He was a very good point guard for Hofstra College when we both went there, beat a lot of good teams, Manhattan and Iona, as I recall. And anyway, Kurt's there. Raise your hand, Kurt. He's a good friend, and a bunch of the old jocks from Hofstra get together, and they let me go. I was their publicist back in the day. I was the student publicist. So when we meet at a place near Penn Station, Kurt comes up by train, and Brant Allier, who lives in Philadelphia, right? Kurt, around here. Brant played in the major leagues in baseball. Brant was the leaper on the team, and you know, big boy up front, and all of these guys, and they've done so well. One of them was a Stephen Dunn, who taught at Stockton College out here, won a Pulitzer Prize for poetry. He was the shooting guard on the team. I mean, it was Hofstra was doing okay. So anyway, that's where I come from. And their coach was Butch Van Bredekhoff, the old Princeton guy. You know, those of you who are sports fans, and Butch was a basketball coach. He was also the assistant soccer coach. He'd been an All-American at Princeton, and it was just a thrill. I don't make a whole thing of this in the book. I mentioned Butch. I remember playing intramural gym soccer. I'd take it every fall just to be around Butch and the other basketball coach. They ran this basketball, special kind of soccer class in the afternoon, and it was just great fun to be on the field. And the first great player, aside from my high school captain I ever played with, was Butch. He would come on the field, big cigar in his mouth. I mean, this is one of the most hedonistic people you've ever met. You know, never, always had a cigar. And he'd go out there and he'd take one of the positions and play. And he could put the ball 30 or 40 yards and put it on somebody's foot. Just, he'd been an All-American. So to be on a field with somebody that good, his dad had been a Dutch Olympic player back in the day. And to be on the field with Butch, I was never in a basketball game with him, but it was great fun. So that's where I come from. That's my soccer background, and that's how I happen to be here writing about the beautiful game and writing this book. I'm honored to be here. I appreciate you being here, and I am here for the duration. I will be glad to answer questions if you all have them. The young lady is here with the microphone, and anything you want, glad to answer. Please.
This is not really a question, but I recognize the changes that have happened. Both electronic and immigration had caused soccer to be so big in the United States. But I was living in New York City when the Cosmos Club was formed, and when Pelé was playing and he scored a goal, they were showing a commercial. Right. So it shows how much has changed, you know, as far as being able to view the games.
Oh, it's a very good point. It's one of the reasons the networks had a hard time with soccer. They didn't want to put it on in 1984 at the Olympics. ABC had the contract, and they were very uncomfortable with it. They want to show commercial. They just didn't know what. I mean, Kurt would remember because he was working the business in that time. But they just didn't know what to do with it. The only match I think they showed on television was the final between, as I recall, France and Brazil. But if you couldn't stop for 45 minutes, I mean, nowadays with bigger screens and the electronics, they can put crawlers in there. And ESPN is putting on a very obtrusive. That hand thing that they're slapping in there, it's so annoying. You know, it takes up a quarter of the screen, and they just put it up there for a second or two, but it's just enough to disrupt you. But I guess if it pays the bills, if it's giving us what ESPN, and I've seen a little bit of Univision, what they're showing us is the whole tournament in real time, and I guess compared to 1982, it's good. But you're right; it's come a long way for the electronics of it. But they see the audience. I mean, the ratings that came in today for these two U.S. matches, and particularly the second one, and you can only imagine what they'll be for a noon match, which maybe isn't necessarily the best time. But the third one is noon on Thursday against Germany. Questions, please.
George, I was the one who called on Radio Times today, and thank you for your wonderful response to that question about Qatar. It was very eloquent, your response to that. Tonight I wanted to ask you about, you just mentioned in Barcelona how you experienced the things in the streets. Do you recollect any one of the host cities after a final memorable thoughts about perhaps one of the best celebrations post-World Cup final that you could share with us?
I appreciate the man is not a plant. What a wonderful question. Thank you so much. It just gives me a chance to talk about something I didn't do in the main talk, which is in 1998, we were in Paris. Also, hard duty, as my wife will attest. We rented a flat of a writer, a nice little place on the right bank, and I went to the match. I was going to go to cover the match. My wife came up with a ticket. We knew somebody who was working doing publicity for McDonald's. So she got taken in the limo right in, you know, 15 minutes before game time. And I knew that she was going. I didn't realize how good a seat it was. But there was this crazy game, 1998, the final, Brazil against the host country. And to stand there in the stadium, this outside, just the edge of Saint-Denis, right outside Paris, and to see the entire place filled and this beautiful anthem that I've known since I was a little kid. And they're playing the Marseillaise. And I love France. We've been there. We've lived there a bit and on and off. And I just love it. And I love the music and to see it. And then out on the field, Brazil was one soap opera, the business with Ronaldo being whatever was wrong with him, we still don't know. But France played, even with the suspicions about Brazil, France played a perfect game led by Zidane, the great French player, and all the controversy in France about maybe the team was a little bit too technicolor, a little bit too too many different nationalities on the team to be truly French. When the French get obsessed about that, of course, in America we have no race issues at all, so we're fine. But the French were going crazy about it, and here comes Zidane, you know, from North African, from Berber background. He scores these two beautiful headers, and we wrote about it. We wrote about the Ronaldo mystery, and then leaving the stadium that night, you don't know what's happening around the place, but we hailed a cab, four or five of the reporters. And this guy, I believe he was Arab, old man, and he was driving us downtown, and we're going through the Arab neighborhood, and people were rocking our cab back and forth, but gently, nicely, and they're chanting, Zidane, 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 and it was nice. And so we opened the windows, and we're handshaking out, giving people fives, fist bumps, and the whole thing, just the joy of getting through, and everything was sweet and nice, and you could hear this echo all through the city, Zidane. And I get back to our apartment, I go upstairs, and Marianne has supper for me, and she's telling me that not only was she at the game, which I knew, but that she had been in like a 10th or 12th row down in the end where Zidane made the two headers. So she had the view of him into space. And by the way, I mentioned this in the book, and I never can remember the name of it. There's a 5-minute YouTube online of Zidane. It's called All in the Game or All in the something or other. His footwork, it's not the header, that was automatic, but the footwork in that game was as beautiful. It was ballet, and I described some of the ballet moves that he made. It was just gorgeous, but if you can find it. Anyway, I didn't realize at the time how artistic, how beautiful, except for the headers. But we're up in our room, and she said, you got to hear this. So we go to the window, we open it up, and our street, we were three or four blocks away from the Champs-Élysées, from the Place de la Concorde, and you could hear footsteps in the streets, people going down in the ancient streets, going down toward the Champs-Élysées, toward the Place de la Concorde, and where people had been going for revolution, for the guillotine, for the demonstrations in 68, and there's Paris just below us in the dark at midnight or whatever time it was, and people are going to celebrate or whatever, the historic place, and you can hear the chant, Zidane, Zidane. So thank you for the question. That was France, Paris, 1998. I'll never forget it. The only time I've ever seen the host country win, and to be in a place we love was a treat. Thank you. Questions, please.
John Oliver recently did a very poignant piece on his HBO show about the controversy surrounding the FIFA organization, particularly in regards to the construction of the stadiums in Qatar, as well as some of the controversy around the Brazilian Cup, particularly the Banal Stadium, the million spent, and how it will be virtually unusable moving forward. I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
I've seen bits of it. I know who he is. And he's right, whatever he said. You can't, for TV comedians and, commentators, wherever he falls into the commentator, journalistic, wherever that is, innately, I suspect he's right. The thing that I think has come out of the last few years, and this goes into the subtitle of my book, is that the dark side of soccer, and it grew on me as I was working on the book, as the top people kept getting disappeared for all the criminality, that I realized that all the people that have been sneering at us, this Charles de Gaulle lookalike, João Avalanche, this Brazilian who only speaks French out in the world and thinks he's de Gaulle, he'd been snooting at us for years. He's banished from soccer for financial impropriety. So was his former son-in-law, Teixeira, Brazilian guy. And all of these people had gone leading right up to the top. Now, that's what the background is of being told by FIFA's top guy, Sepp Blatter, was looking for a Nobel Prize for years, for going fighting against racism and for opening the World Cup, moving it to other places, and admirably moving it to South Africa to put it in that continent for the first time, admirably. And I agree with that. You can't just hold it in rich first world countries like the United States or, soccer places in Europe or whatever. You have to move it around. But that leads us to Qatar and to the whole foolishness of having it there. Blatter, for reasons of his own, decided to have a double vote for the hosts of 2018 and 2022. so much of FIFA is run by people getting paid off. These people get paid tremendous amounts of money just for showing up as delegates. Their expense accounts are amazing. There are lots of people have done actual investigative work that I'm sure Oliver is reacting to or working off. Entire books. There's a guy named Andrew Jennings, old-fashioned English muckraker who's been writing, you know, nasty stuff for years. Some of it true. You know, much of it true. And it's all out there. And the Times of London, the Guardian have all been doing it. The New York Times has done some very good work. So it's all out there, but it's leading to this point where Qatar won that vote for 2022 because people were trading votes. France, country I love, traded votes. Sarkozy wanted Qatar to get it. He had this guy Platini, who was a great player, a very active big guy in sports politics, now FIFA politics. He said he was going to vote for the United States. He voted for Qatar. As soon as the vote was in, as soon as Qatar was the host for 2022, the Qatar Foundation went in with and spent money to take over the Paris Saint-Germain team, bolstering that, making it one of the great teams in the world, able to afford Ibrahimovic. I'm going to a lot of detail, but that's the kind of stuff that goes on in FIFA. FIFA is the most dirty, opaque sports organization I know. They make the IOC look like Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts. The one thing that's happened in this whole process, and I don't know what's going to happen about Qatar, to answer again the question that was asked this afternoon, I do know this, that once you've awarded to a country, it's not definite, but you can't really just take it away saying, we screwed up, we FIFA screwed up, we made a mistake. We just discovered Platini about 6 months ago, you know, Frenchman, great player, played in Italy. He just discovered recently that it gets hot in Qatar in the summer. Who knew? So now Platini is saying, well, maybe we could move the World Cup to the winter. And here's the guy who played his winters in Turin and Milan, and he knows that it exists in Europe, but if you tried to put the World Cup in, you'd be killing the schedule. So they're all screwed up. I think the one thing that's happened is that FIFA has been found out. You can't just take the World Cup away saying, we had a few bad apples, took some bribes. Sepp Blatter knew nothing about it. You know, he knew nothing. He was ignorant. Nobody told him a thing. So he's just finding it out now. You can't take it away from Qatar so easily because where are you going to put it? That's the real issue here, is I know one country that wants no part of the 2022 World Cup, and I can only tell you I know this, and they shouldn't want, and that's the United States of America, to be given a World Cup. I mean, the United States could hold a World Cup 6-8 months out. You said to them, Colombia defaulted for the 1986. The United States could have done it, and with a couple of years' notice, it went to Mexico. Okay, made sense. But you can't take it and put it in the United States. The United States doesn't want it. Doesn't want to take a World Cup away from a nation that is an oil nation in the Middle East and is also, if I can say this, is an Islamic country, doesn't want that World Cup put down in its shores. It would be foolish in every geopolitical way. So it would go somewhere else. The United States is going to wait. 2026 is going to come around. I predict there will be a World Cup stretching from Toronto, Vancouver, the United States, Mexico City. Somebody called it the NAFTA World Cup. This is already, it's already in there. I'm sort of, people know about that. I mean, it's kind of in the pipeline somewhere of being talked about. But it could happen better than taking over 2020. I don't know. FIFA's stuck with it. But then again, FIFA deserves everything it gets. If Blatter somehow was voted out, but it's a very rigid organization. There's almost no bend. The only thing that's going to happen with FIFA, and this is the dark side, the only thing that could happen with FIFA is that the sponsors, the people that pay the bills for the World Cup, if they would withhold their support, and this happened, there's a history to this. In the Olympic movement, late 1990s, it was discovered that Salt Lake City was giving lots of bribes to African IOC delegates and all that, and Salt Lake City was disgraced. They did two things. They kicked out the leaders of it. They brought in a clean guy named Mitt Romney, who did a very good job running it, and a sponsor named David D'Alessandro from John Hancock said, we're not going to go spending our company's money to support this kind of criminality by local burgers in Salt Lake City. They got to clean up their act or Prudential is out of here. That scared them. So money talks until the multinationals speak and say to FIFA, get rid of Blatter, bring in somebody from the outside. I mean, whoever that would be, but get somebody in from the outside. FIFA is going to continue to be. FIFA's a joke has been found out. Thank you.
I have two questions. My first question is, what advice would you give to an aspiring writer or journalist? And I also have another question. How would you describe your writing process?
Okay. I'm going to give you the short version of it, because clearly there are long versions. The very short version to your first question is don't. Don't go into journalism. Corinna, did I tell you don't go into journalism? Did I tell your sister?
Yes.
Did I tell your brother?
Yes, you did.
What'd they do?
No,
well, she went straight for a while. She became a lawyer. But ultimately, journalism is in there. So yeah, I won't tell you since I was 0 for 3 and telling our kids what to do. Follow your heart. How do you get into it? I don't know. Journalism is changing. The business that I knew, even the business that I started out in Paris, there were 50, at least 50 American journalists. Of course, it was Paris, and who wouldn't want to go? But we were able to boondoggle our trip over there and support it because the U.S. had a team, et cetera, et cetera. It's changing in so many ways. The online thing. I don't know how anybody's making money. Newspapers are not. I mean, look, I'm in a city that doesn't know, you know, where this wonderful paper is going. You know, ownership. It's a tough time. I don't have to tell you that, but there are forms of journalism. People are investigating, are writing, and in the broader sense, writing will never go out of fashion. Investigating, writing, however you do it, if you want to have an unstable future, not know how you'll support yourself, how you'll eat, you know, be my guest. But and I hope you do. I don't know if that answers your question, but it's just a tough business. Where do you start? In the old days, you went to a newspaper, a daily newspaper, and said, you know, let's say in sports. You said, I can work a couple nights a week taking high school. That's how I started, you know, at Hofstra. While I was writing about my guys playing the sports there, I also went to Newsday. Newsday was a growing paper. They had part-time jobs. Two nights a week, I'd go in and take high school basketball games over the phone. That stuff is... It doesn't exist the same way. Nobody's paying somebody to come in. But wherever you think there's a job, whatever you think journalism is, and however you define journalism as reality, transcribing reality, presenting it out, your own form of it, your opinions, your reporting, you know, follow your heart. But it's just a different business. And for an old guy who came along at the top of the wave, I mean, I was in great position coming all along. Newsday was a great paper when I came along. I went to the Times later. Newsday's now run by some Cablevision family, and it reads like a shopping throwaway. There's nothing in it, nothing to read. They don't even send people to the Olympics or the World Cup. They've cut it up. But whatever the future is of journalism, however you define it, and the web obviously is a huge part of it, given the papers are going over to that, do it. As far as writing process, I'll give you a very quick synopsis. It's write every day, write as often as possible. To wait for the muse to hit you is... nobody has time for that. What you need to do is to get up every morning. My wife was sitting next to a guy at a dinner a couple of years ago. He'd been working... I'm not going to say who it was, because... He'd been working on a book for about 7 years and couldn't get it done. It was a major project. And he said, how does your husband do it? And she said, well, you know, he gets up early every morning and he has breakfast, and by 7:30, he's at his laptop writing. And this fascinated the guy. He was like, really? You know, she said, yeah, that's his first priority. You know, he makes me coffee, gets me, you know. And he locks the door to his room and he writes. So whatever works for you, whatever the process is, but And everybody, some people are night people. Some writers are night people. They do what they have to do. And I read about novelists who write beautiful fiction, and they wait until the evening when everything's quiet or the electronic, you know, the buzz is out of the air or something. Whatever works for you. But for me, it's in the morning when your head is clear, but you have to put things on paper. Or these days, in the laptop. And it's so easy to write on computers. It's so easy to store things, to cut. You know, I talked about moving my chapter. You know how easy it was to move that Donovan goal from the back of the book to the front of the book? Cut and paste. What a wonderful thing. In the old days, I can't see, but it sounds like you're not as old as I am. In the old days, you actually had to cut and paste. It was time consuming. Nowadays, bing, and you've moved a whole chapter and you've moved stuff around. So it's so much easier to really write. Any writer, I understand people get locked, old people get locked into the procedures that work for us, but anybody that's not using a tool like that to write and to just to be able to have volumes of stuff and move it around, go find it a year later in a file, but do whatever you can. The writing process has to be as much... Kurt will tell you that when they went out to practice basketball, it was the repetition. It was being in a place where you'd been before. The coach had certain things that he could do. He would practice them. You know, move the ball. He's a point guard. Move the ball. Get it around. We had a guy who was only allowed to get to rebound and be up close. Practice what you're supposed to do. Practice what the best part of it is, and you will be further along. So to me, it sounds maybe it's a little simplistic because I can't talk to you about inspiration or subject matter. That's for you to decide. But the first thing you have to do is to put yourself in a position where, you know, it's like John Wooden. The first thing he had his players do every fall when they came out for basketball at UCLA. Kurt, you know the story? He did socks. Before shoes, socks. You have to make sure your socks were pulled all the way in. Have I ever told you that? It's the great thing that he would teach them. He'd get them on October 15th and say, you pull your socks on, make sure there's no, so you won't get blisters. Oh, I talked, when Wooden passed, I called him up. I called his, one, a guy who played for him named Rich Levin, who later worked in the commissioner's office in baseball. And he was a kind of a, 12th guy on a couple of championship teams. I said, Rich, tell me about the socks and the shoes. And he'd say, it's true. October 15th, we'd be learning how to put our socks and shoes on the right way. But whatever the writing equivalent of it is, think about John Wooden and get yourself in position to be, not to get blisters and to be working. I don't know if that helps, but that's part one of chapter one. Questions, please.
Thank you. Pep Guardiola and his family in 2012 lived at 88th and Central Park West.
Right.
Do you know to what extent U.S. Soccer Federation or any other soccer organizations in the States engaged him or attempted to engage him during that year that he was here in a sabbatical?
You know, Pep Guardiola was the coach of Barca, terrific coach, worldly guy. He left Barcelona, his home. Guardiola is an old Catalan name. My minder in 1992 in Barcelona was named Inés Guardiola. I have a picture of the two of us somewhere on the last day. It's an amazing thing about soccer players. They love New York. Yuri Djorkaeff lives in Gramercy Park. People recognize he was on the French 1998 team, and he lives in New York because while people recognize him and he runs a restaurant and he's around, he's a guy around town, they don't go crazy. Del Piero, who just retired recently or finished up with the national team in Italy, Del Piero told me that he loves to come to New York because while people recognize him, he can go around. So it's a great place to be. Klinsmann. Klinsmann lives in Southern California. He can go out with his kids to the beach, and there's Klinsmann. That's nice. Why did you not have Donovan on the team? But whatever it is, and nobody asked. Okay, so the answer is, here's Guardiola living in the middle of New York City, and I knew he was in New York. I didn't know he was at Central Park West, but I know that Klinsmann has been on their minds. In fact, Klinsmann had this job. He was offered it when Arena left in 2006, and Bradley took over. Bradley and both Bruce Arena and Bob Bradley they know the game. They did a great job. They were instrumental in moving this thing forward. But Sunil Gulati has been after Klinsmann for a long time, and Klinsmann was living in California. I don't know that there was any conversation. I couldn't tell you there was or wasn't. And if your question is why wasn't there, since Guardiola had done such a good job, I don't know. Do you have any insight into whether Guardiola would have wanted it? Or Sunil Gulati lives up by Colombia. He is so plugged in. It wouldn't surprise me. You know, the answer is I don't know anything. I've never asked Sunil about it, but at some point I'll ask Sunil when he gets back to New York, or I could email him now in Brazil, but I won't. I would be sure that at some point he and Guardiola, Sunil knows everybody, and I'd be stunned if he didn't have some contact with him, whether it was official. But he's been after Klinsmann for so long. He already had Klinsmann signed up as of 2011. Bradley came back from South Africa, coached for a little while, and then was dropped. So Klinsmann only took this job in 2011. But
I didn't even sign him. I just
went to talk to him?
Why did the NSCAA have him come speak here at the National
Convention? I can't answer why. I think Guardiola needed a rest from football. He needed to get away. And it is... New York is a good place to get away because famous athletes who are not... Even American... I mean, Derek Jeter can go out to dinner in New York and they don't go as crazy as world soccer fans go over soccer people. And in New York, you're used to celebrity. People go out, you see people... blah, blah, blah. I don't know what Guardiola's condition was. I know that he needed to get away. So why didn't they? He may have not wanted to, but I really, now I'm speaking from ignorance because I really don't know what his mindset. I know he's a worldly guy. I know that he needed to get away and try living somewhere else, but I couldn't. The specifics, I don't know. Anyway, thank you. Thank you all very much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.